From UFOs to psychic powers and government conspiracies, history is riddled with unexplained events. You can turn back now or learn the stuff they don't want you to know.
Welcome back to the show. My name is Matt.
My name is Noel.
They call me Ben. We are joined with our super producer, Paul, Mission Control Deck, and most importantly, you are you. You are here, and that makes this Stuff They Don't Want You to Know. A bit of a depressing episode, to be completely honest. I had a little bit of a dark night of the soul doing some of this research. But on a positive note, it reminded me of my college days, and I wanted to ask you guys, just generally speaking, did you have a good time in college?
No.
No?
I kind of had like a really boring, I stayed in my hometown college experience, So I just sort of continued life as I knew it in high school in many ways, and then after college, I kind of had a college experience when I wasn't actually in college. I moved to Athens, Georgia. Mm-hmm. A lot of my friends had gone to UGA. I ended up going to a lot of like house shows and house parties, but it was just after my college experience. It was a little removed. It was kind of interesting, actually. Mm-hmm. I sort of like it.
What about you, Matt?
I had a wonderful college experience. Met my wife, met some of my closest friends, started a company, got hired here. Yeah, all of that occurred while I was in college. So
bully for you, man.
Good
bully
stuff.
That's right. That's
the,
right.
Yeah, the actual college was a little boring.
You know, a lot of people end up saying something along those lines. You'll find, and this may be your experience as well, folks, you'll find that many people see the financial or career benefits of college as equal to, or in some cases less important than, the social benefits, such as, you know, meeting your significant other, making mm-hmm. lifelong friends, and you know, the social aspects. We are a very tribal species. The social aspects are inherently tied up in any institution. I mean, one of the big benefits of a fraternity is going to be, I mean, I'm sure there's a nicer word for nepotism, but that's what it is.
It's a
social network.
Yeah,
right.
Exactly.
So we hope that if you went to college, or if you are in college, or you're planning to go to college, that you have a great time. We also hope that you're very careful. For much of recent U.S. history, graduating college has been seen as one of those key prerequisites to later success in adulthood. And you'll read statistics that argue something along the lines of a bachelor's degree is over the lifespan of the person who holds the degree. It's worth several million dollars in terms of how it enhances their ability to earn money.
Over time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's the first asterisk here. But while that's true, while it's true that the average lifetime earnings of people with a degree has tended to be about 75% higher than that of people with a high school diploma or less, that doesn't tell the entire story. Sure, there does appear to be a tangible financial benefit, but that's at first blush. That's at a cursory glance. What we also find is that we live in a society, and this is something we talked about previously on our tour, we live in a society where a lot of people were convinced that to have any worth or value as an individual in this, our current age, they had to go to college. Even if they got a degree that they didn't really care about, even if they got a degree that wasn't particularly applicable to their later interest in life, they just had to jump through this social hoop to be a person worth knowing or acknowledging as a person. And that is fundamentally, first disclaimer, I know I'm monologuing here, but that is fundamentally not true. Trade jobs right now will make as much, if not way more, money for the person who is employed in that position than, you know, a job that we would consider maybe more high end. So the person who works in an HVAC job, for instance, may be pulling in bank, and you might not have any idea. So
Or driving trucks.
Or driving trucks, right? Or working in manufacturing. These are fundamentally these are fundamentally crucial jobs to the American economy.
Not to mention, I mean, just like working in like high-end restaurants on the wait staff. I mean, you can pull in crazy amounts of tips, $300 a night, more, you know? I mean,
it's a bartender.
Oh, man. Mm-hmm. I mean, you don't have to go to school for that at all. I mean, again, we're not saying don't go to school.
Right.
There is a disparity in this like myth that sort of pushed this American dream, which is usually the case with American dream type ideas, that there are lots of ways to skin a financial cat.
That's right. But if you do want to get in the upper echelons and find yourself in that 1%, that 0.01%.
Make yourself a podcast.
No. Definitely please don't do that. Unless your name is Ira. But then, let's see. I would say you have to have a college degree to make that kind of leap to those like heights, most likely, except for with the exception of maybe a handful of people that have ever gotten that through investing and through family funding.
Oh, sure. By family funding you mean inheritance,
yes.
Then that is clearly, I mean, that is the primary avenue for 1% hood.
It's
the game is broken.
Yeah.
The game is more broken than Monopoly, which is probably the most famous of broken games. But before we get all gloom and doom about it, let's get straight to the heart of the matter. There does appear to be this tangible financial benefit. It is your choice whether you decide to go to college. And I think what we're saying here at the offset is that you should not feel like you have to. That just try to think very clearly and carefully through the process, because it is a big decision, you know.
It is.
And debt is much like a tattoo. It can stay with you for the rest of your life, and it's very difficult to remove.
Debt comes for us all.
Right. And that brings us to today's question. Is there a student loan conspiracy? Or to phrase it a different way, what the hell is going on with student loans in this country? I don't think that's an unfair question.
I don't think so at all. Let's start with what exactly a student loan is. Well, it's right in the name. It's a loan. Somebody, some institution is going to give you a large chunk of cash so that you can specifically in this case use it to pay for tuition, for books, for housing, student housing, for food, for whatever you need in order to get through your college experience.
And that money is often going to be distributed in some degree in a lump sum kind of fashion.
Yeah.
So that some goes straight to your school or your institution of learning, and then some other portion goes to you, and it's up to you as an individual to parse that out and budget that out. And a lot of us, when we're in college, we end up spending that on really cool adventures.
Yeah.
instead of school books, but those books are a racket all their own. That's a different podcast.
My gosh, $300 for a textbook? That sounds right.
Mm-hmm. But you can sell it back for $35 at the end of the term.
To the same place that sold it to you.
It's like my DVD investments.
How's that going for you, man?
Oh, my God. I tried. I recently was like, I'm going to get rid of the clutter. And I haven't watched these DVDs in years. So I boxed them all up, took them with high hopes to a secondhand book place.
Did you go to Book Nook?
I went to Book Nook. They handed back almost 90% of them to me and offered me about $10 in store credit for the ones that they wanted.
Wow. In store credit.
Yeah. Yeah, it was pretty embarrassing.
Did you take it?
I mean, they literally only wanted like five things out of like several hundred.
Yeah.
And they're still in the back of my Honda Fit.
Well, much like you, Noel, these student loan companies offer everyone these loans. But unlike your DVDs, these loans are very enticing. Because a lot of times they have low interest rates, at least comparatively to other loans that you might get.
Like 3 to 7%.
Yeah, that's really nice. And also you have a grace period. Like if you see one of those credit cards that says, you know, you don't have to pay anything for 12 months or something, or 0% APR for 12 months.
Just screw your life up for a year.
Yeah. And then
and then get another one of those 0% offers and
pay
just
off
keep
that
bouncing
one.
It around.
Yeah.
But for real, that's why these loans, perhaps at least one of the reasons these loans are so enticing, because of that interest rate in the pretty long grace period.
Well, and because it goes to a good cause.
Yeah.
Right? It is furthering your education. Education is widely agreed. I want to be careful about how I say this because some people might object. Education is widely agreed to be a public good. We can all agree that depending on the type of education we're talking about, knowing things like engineering, math, literacy, that sort of stuff, these things are just matters of fact rather than opinion. The more people who are aware of these things, the more people who are competent in these disciplines, the better society will tend to be.
Huzzah.
It's true. We can't – I mean, everybody – the world is not going to automatically be perfect if everybody gets a chance to study trigonometry. But that is a positive factor. You know, learning is – knowledge is power.
Yeah. It wouldn't hurt anything except for maybe everybody would be a little more bothered by simple things that require complex trigonometry that I just don't understand.
I know. Also – trigonometry may not be the best example, but it is true that these loans are for good cause. They have a grace period typically sometime after an education is completed. So while you are a student, past a certain threshold of course hours, you will not have to pay this loan. Not all student loans are the same. Some are federally funded by these United States of America. Some are private. And some are designed specifically like Pell Grants to help financially needy students. And those aren't really loans. That's money that is given to you.
Yeah.
Some offer protection for borrowers and then, of course, interest rates that should be below market. And when the federal government issues these loans, they offer low fixed interest rates, and that makes them more attractive in contrast to private loans that may have a variable rate of some sort. So we don't have to get too far in the weeds on the different types of loans other than to establish the primary categories that differentiate student loans from any other kind of loan you would get. They're not a mortgage. They're not a car note, et cetera. These have private public lenders. They have qualification requirements, right? Mm-hmm. The primary one being that you can't get a student loan unless you're going to be a student. They have lower interest rates, and they have flexibility on their payment schedules and their timelines. You said that these were enticing, Matt.
Yes.
You're absolutely right. Tons of people have student loans. There are more than 44 million borrowers and people who have a student loan with some outfit in the country as we speak now. Yeah, and they had to. In many ways, these people were forced into this because in the decade between 2006 and 2016, the overall cost of college rose 63%.
It's true.
And that increased student loan debt by four times. The student loan debt now is at around 1.5, get ready for this, trillion.
Okay.
With a T, like T-Boz and TLC.
Yep. Can't calculate it. My trigonometry skills are not up to par as they should be.
Did you take trig?
I did. I took advanced trig, but I had no idea.
I kind of muddled my way through algebra, man. I was not good. Math is not my strong suit. I've got the gift of gab, my friends.
So it's tough to think of 1.5 trillion. It's distressingly difficult for most of us to comprehend, to really comprehend what a billion is. You know what I mean? So one way that could be helpful to get our heads around what 1.5 trillion is to compare it to other things. Facebook is worth 541.5 billion-ish. Microsoft, 750.6 billion.
Okay.
These are ballparking. That means that the American student loan debt is worth more than those two entities put together. It's about $521 billion more than all the credit card debt in this country combined.
Whoa.
It's big money.
That's so insane. Big, so big that it's like ephemeral made-up money. Like, I don't know. It just seems unquantifiably huge to me. Like, I mean, I get that it is, in fact, by its very nature, quantifiable. But it just seems like GDP kind of money, you know? I mean, it's bonkers.
Or total U.S. debt kind of money back in the day. And now that's just ridiculous. But, yeah, I see what you're saying. That's – wow. Well, what's the what's like the average amount that each person is like carrying around with?
For people in the class of 2016, for instance, the average student would graduate with $37,172 in student loan debt.
Just to offer a counterpoint, I was lucky in that I had Hope Scholarship, which is a Georgia thing. I think probably Matt did as well.
We're all pumping
our fists here. I did still take out a couple of student loans, but it was to pay for like equipment that I wanted for my studies. I was doing film work, and I wanted like a nice computer and all of that, and just ways to supplement my income while I was in school.
Yeah,
even though I worked, but it was like a crappy job at a music store. But so I don't have that much student loan debt, but it is the one that I pay attention to the least because of the fact that the interest rate's so low, and it takes them so long to actually come after you and call you and be like, "Hey, you forgot to pay your loan." And it's not that I can't afford to pay it. I just kind of forget, and I need to set it up on like an auto draft. But I think that a lot of people are in that boat because it's not as urgent feeling sometimes, unless you're just not paying at all. Then they'll start trying to take out, garnish your wages, or there's definitely recourse that they can take, but it hasn't been that big of a deal to me.
So for background, for anyone who hasn't heard of this or is outside of Georgia where a podcast is based, Hope is a state level college attendance assistance program, financial assistance program for college, based on people's grade point average, originally based on the revenue for the Georgia lottery program, which was great press for the lottery here. Other states have similar things, and similar to the Hope Scholarship, those things are increasingly, in a lot of situations, they're increasingly endangered by legislation. So we don't know how long they're going to be around, but they did some great stuff for college students. We personally, this is my opinion, I hope those kind of things continue. But the most important point about those kinds of programs is they typically do not give you a full ride.
Yeah.
You can have Hope Scholarship. You will still need money for supplies. You'll probably still need money for textbooks. You'll still need to find a place to live. You know what I mean? But something's better than nothing, right? Still, these loans remain popular. Among the class of 2018, congratulations to everyone who graduated college last year.
Big ups.
Yeah, this is a massive achievement, and I wish you the best in your coming adventures. Let us know what your experience is like. Without having ever met, I can say that if you're listening now, there is an overwhelming likelihood that you also took out student loans sometime before you graduated in 2018. 69% of you did. And everyone who graduated, if we take everyone as one big group, that was an average debt of $29,800, including both private and federal. And 14% of the parents of people who graduated in 2018 took out an average of $35,600 in federal parent plus loans.
Wow.
I know. This is a lot of money on the table, but what price can you put on your future? So in many ways, this large agglomeration of debt has altered American society. Multiple generations now are far less likely to successfully purchase a home or start a family around the same time their parents, their grandparents, other predecessors did. It's simply not the reality anymore that someone can get out of college, get an entry-level job, and then buy a car and pay it off in a few years, and then buy a house. That doesn't happen anymore.
Especially in certain cities, as real estate just goes bonkers, you know, like Atlanta, the way it's being gentrified and stuff. I mean, you can't find a house around here for under $270,000 for like a starter home, and anything like below that is going to be like a massive fixer-upper, which is like scary in and of itself.
And then can quickly become $270,000 total worth of work. So instead, what people will end up doing when bedeviled by these inescapable loans is they'll say, okay, I have to push off this one milestone until I can figure a way out of this hole, or at least to get it to a more manageable place.
Yeah, that's what my wife did. It was not a good idea.
So is this a case of pure mistake, pure misstep? Is this a comedy of errors on the part of economists, the people in charge of deciding how much tuition should cost, the federal government, private lenders, would-be college students, continuing college students, people who are returning students? Is it accidental mismanagement on any one particular person's part? Or is there something else at play?
We'll get to that after a quick sponsor break.
Yes, there is.
Here's where it gets crazy. Totally, arguably, yes. Arguably, this is 100% something purposeful, but maybe not a grand conspiracy.
Yeah.
But maybe several different groups of motivated
stakeholders.
Sure, stakeholders. Yeah. I was going to say very greedy institutions.
All right. Well.
But no, it's. I mean, it's true. They are stakeholders, right?
Yeah. Greedy institutions that see you as a money battery.
Yes, as a money battery that they don't ever have to throw away.
Yep.
Till you die. So the first student loans, if we want to look at a quick timeline of this, we can just run through this super quickly. First student loans in the U.S. were offered exclusively to kids at Harvard way back in 1840. And there were no public loans until the 20th century. And the U.S. Department of Education was founded in, 1867. They didn't give out federal student loans until the passage of something called Title IV of the Higher Education Act, or HEA, in 1965.
So in the two decades before the institution of federally guaranteed student loans, the U.S. experienced a significant increase in college attendance, thanks in large part to the passage of the 1944 GI Bill. And fulfilling this need for affordable higher education, the GI Bill actually subsidized or entirely paid for the cost of college education for nearly half of Americans returning for World War II. And you have to remember, this was a time where this was not an option. So this was like a big deal, and it was also a large percentage of our able-bodied men that were going off to war and then coming back and getting this benefit. So since its inception, the program has remained popular over the years. And it's true. A lot of people nowadays that it is a choice to join the military do so because of those GI Bill benefits.
Which is a slippery slope when you think about it.
It really is. Or they re-up. You know, I mean, there's a whole thing behind it.
So by 1976 or 1977 – all undergraduate students became eligible for something we mentioned earlier, Pell Grants. And these two popular programs, the GI Bill and the Pell Grant, increased college attendance rates because people who previously would never have had a chance to obtain the financial support to go to college, they finally had doors that were closed to them open. Good thing, right?
Yeah.
American dream, right? However, not all of this assistance has been beneficial. The problems with student loans started to show up way back in the 1980s.
Oh, yeah. Roughly 1986. That's when basically we as a country realized that we'd incurred around $10 billion in student loans. And if you think about 1986 dollars, $10 billion is like saying $1 trillion. At least it's close if you say that today. So in that same year, more than a quarter of students borrowed, and they owed more than $10,000 if you look at them, you know, per person as an average, more than $10,000 in student loan debt. Wow, that would be nice, just $10,000. I wish it was the 80s again.
$10,000 in 1986 is the equivalent of almost $23,000 in 2018.
I'll still take it.
Still take it. Yeah, it's still a deal, huh? So by the 1990s, student loan debt really began to skyrocket. In 93, the average debt of a bachelor's degree, the average debt burden, was about $9,000. 5 years from then, it was 15,000. And then by 2003, it jumped to 17,500. Let's not forget, this happens in lockstep with what's called wage stagnation.
Yeah.
Wage stagnation is when someone says, you know, well, the minimum wage is this, right? Or I've paid every employee for the past 20 years $32,000, $28,000, whatever, to do this job. Never mind that everything else is becoming more expensive, right?
Yeah.
Never mind that every single one of those $28,000 individually and collectively buys less than it did before. And it's a complex argument, but that's the gist, right? If the cost of living increases, then the demands on an individual budget increase. And if the wage stagnates, there's less and less pie to slice.
Yeah, that's a really good way of looking at it, an unfortunate reality. So you got that wage stagnation, but then you've also got this cultural thing that's happening in the U.S. at the same time, or at least roughly in the same time, where college is seen as an absolute necessity to become successful.
Mm-hmm. Do you want to be an upstanding person?
Yeah.
Do you want to be worth something in this country?
To society?
Mm-hmm.
Go to college.
It doesn't matter what you study.
No, of course not. And also pledge if you can.
Yeah. Underwater basket weaving, if you want to get that.
Is underwater basket weaving like a physical fitness elective?
No, it's the euphemism for someone taking a useless elective.
Oh, there you go. Cool. So, I like it.
Yeah.
My drum instructor used to do that.
They'll also call them Mickey Mouse courses.
Yeah.
I've never heard underwater basket weaving. I love that. Yeah. I want to take that course.
It's probably pretty tough if you think about it. And you have to – it's probably like film. You have to buy a lot of equipment, I imagine. What I'm thinking about this too much.
You really are. I mean, surely you'd have to at least rent some scuba stuff if you were going to – no more tangents.
I guess, like, does your body have to be underwater? Do you just have to put the basket underwater?
Unclear.
There are probably multiple levels. There's like a 101 and a 101. Anyway, let us know if you have experience with underwater basket weaving. At the same time that wages are not increasing, cost of living is increasing, college is becoming seen as a necessity, the cost of just going to college, just the tuition, is increasing precipitously.
Yep.
It's like now not only do you have to go here, but it's way more expensive than any of the other times before you were alive that people went.
Ugh.
And this puts us in a real bind as a society. We have to start asking ourselves who profits. Now, the colleges and universities, that would be first on the list, right? There are nonprofit colleges and there are profit colleges, which could be the subject of their own show, the for-profit colleges, the University of Phoenixes and stuff like that.
Yeesh.
We can probably do a different episode about those, especially the unaccredited ones, which are frankly robbing students blind and going to court over it. But the institutions that we would all like to consider more legitimate also have their fingers in the pie. Colleges have been caught raising costs and blaming the increase on various outside uncontrollable economic pressures. You know what I mean?
Yeah, like our president of the college needs to get paid a lot more millions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right. Yeah. Or we have desperately needed infrastructure maintenance that we have to conduct, right?
Yeah.
Like ours is an old and storied institution and the bridges and the walls won't fix themselves. That asbestos is not going to magically leak. I'm making that last one up. But you know what I mean? It's the argument that we have to maintain and upkeep the institution.
Exactly.
Makes sense. And would make more sense if it was true. It turns out in multiple cases that while these colleges are claiming they need to increase tuition primarily for these maintenance costs or like staff requirements, mm-hmm. pensions, et cetera, what it turns out that they've been doing, they've been squirreling away massive cash reserves outside of endowments.
Mm.
I believe it was West Virginia got caught doing this, and their defense was that other schools do it.
Oh, yeah, of course.
So it's dangerous. And of course, Wall Street investors are in on the game. They're in on the game because if you want to profit from this kind of financial sphere, this financial market, one thing that's really going to stick out to you is that student loan debt, unlike many other kinds of debt, cannot be discharged. Discharge means, you know, let's say, just pick a random coworker of ours. Not one of us, so I don't want to pick on us.
Ramsey.
Okay. So,
hey, leave Ramsey alone.
So our super producer, Ramsey Yunt, who is a fantastic guy, produces Movie Crush, and I think works on Committed as well, right? Ramsey Yunt, let's say, things get weird. He gets too deep in the underwater basket weaving industry, and he has to, for one reason or another, declare bankruptcy. Statistically speaking, in this country, one of the main reason we declare bankruptcy is if something went wrong medically. We're just coming up with different episodes left and right. So let's say this unfortunate thing happens to Ramsey and he is bankrupt, so he gets various debts discharged. Credit card debt, consolidated discharged, mortgage, consolidated discharged. Let's say he loses his house and he has to move to a rental or something. Car note, you know, let's say car's repossessed. Boom. So he gets a fresh start and he keeps his nose clean and maintains good financial hygiene. Then eventually he will recover from this, except for his student loans, which will almost never go away. There is a myth that says student loans never go away during bankruptcy. That's not true. It's just virtually true. It's very, very difficult. Like on the order of 90% of student loans are going to stay with you if you go bankrupt.
Yeah, I'd say generally what I've seen happen is they get deferred just for a time period, and then they just come right back.
Yep. Or, and this may not be the way it works in bankruptcy, they may enter forbearance, which is like the ugly cousin, the ugly, meaner cousin of deferment.
Yep.
So, of course, investors are going to be in this game, because it's a debt that will always need to be paid. And in some cases, it's a debt, depending on the way it's paid, it is a debt that follows people for decades or the entirety of their lives. There are people who have retired who are 65 plus and still are paying their student loans. This is true.
Yeah, there are people in my immediate family that are in that boat.
And it's not discharged. Right? It's not changed. And in some cases, we have people who are paying entirely on the interest or the fees of their loans rather than the principal. There's a great anecdote in the Rolling Stone about a lady named Veronica Martish. She's a 68-year-old veteran at the time of writing. She served in the armed forces during Vietnam. She's a grandmother. She's had a clean record her entire life, and she considers herself a patriot, but student loans ruined her life. In 1989, she took out an $8,000 student loan through Sallie Mae, and then 5 years later, after some people died in her family, she fell behind on her payments. She entered a loan rehab program, and with fees and interest, that original $8,000 loan ballooned into $27,000. She has, this woman, to the date of that article, which was relatively recently, she has paid more than $63,000 to date and is nowhere near getting rid of the principal. From $8,000, just to reiterate, from $8,000 in 1989 to $63,000 paid.
That is terrible. And that is not an uncommon thing, unfortunately. Even if you took out loans in the early 2000s, the ballooning factor and trying to pay down the principal while furiously paying off all that interest, I think we all know what that's like.
Yeah, and I mean, again, I'm not trying to be flippant about it, but mine has not shrunk very much at all. Even though I didn't take out a ton, it's like maybe like $10,000 and like that was what I took out to begin with, maybe even less. It's not that far away from where it was when I started it in like the early 2000s or, you know, around 2004. So, yeah, it's something that even if you don't notice it, it's definitely not doing you any favors, and you are paying into the system by not paying it off, you know?
But, mm-hmm. Yeah, but I can't imagine her situation. That's terrible.
It's heartbreaking.
Yeah.
It's heartbreaking. And, of course, as we have encountered in so many other episodes or so many other subjects, so many other stories, whenever the federal government is involved and a problem occurs, everybody in the government says, harumph, 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 something must be done.
Harumph, harumph, harumph. Let's figure out what's going on here.
Do they say that?
Yeah.
Yeah, everybody whispers in Congress now.
Got it.
It's library rules.
Yeah.
We will tell you what the government thinks about this and what their involvement is after a word from our sponsor. So, yes, Uncle Sammy Boy, the feds, Big Brother.
Sam the Sham.
The United States of America. Sam the Sham, great band, by the way, great performer. The federal government is the biggest lender of American student loans. This makes sense. For years and years and years, a lot of this money was managed by private banks and loan companies like Sally Mae, who I have often referred to as my real long-term girlfriend.
Mm-hmm. Only now, it's not even Sally Mae anymore. We'll get to that in a second.
Yeah.
In 2010, Congress cut out the middleman of their lending fees, and Sally Mae spun off its servicing arm into the publicly traded company Navient, which is a weird name for a girlfriend, but just the same, there she is.
You know.
She's actually gender – Navient is gender neutral.
Yeah, it's 2019.
That's
right? True. So Navient's not too far from Sally Mae, though. They're led by former execs from Sally Mae, and the company describes itself as a leading provider of asset management and business processing solutions – I know – for education, healthcare, and government clients.
Huh.
But it's best known – on these mean financial streets as being one of the very lucky companies that won coveted federal contracts to make sure students repay their loans, and that's where the trouble begins.
Why are these coveted, you might ask? Navient is the primary point of contact or the servicer for more student loans in the United States than any other company, handling 12 million borrowers and $300 billion in debt. So surely there's money to be made with those kind of figures.
Yeah, and the company really, really made it big, at least under the Obama administration. Not necessarily that the administration had anything to do with it, but while during that time, they flourished, let's say. Its stock rose sharply after the election of Donald Trump, which is nice. That occurred not that long ago, and a lot of other companies saw a big spike there. But Navient also has a ton of complaints. They've got more complaints than any other borrower, any other servicer. And this is according to a fusion analysis of data over a course of years.
Right, right. So these complaints have a running theme. The theme is that the company, Navient, has failed to live up to the terms of its contracts and that it illegally harasses consumers. I'm sure we all have friends and maybe some personal experience, not to call anybody out, wherein Navient stalks you, right?
From random numbers.
From random numbers, right?
Seriously.
But Navient says in their defense that most of the anger that they're getting from consumers – and notice they say consumers, not former students. It's like, what did we already did an episode of that, right?
Yeah.
No, the citizens became consumers.
We've touched on that.
That was a different show.
That was a different show.
But we've touched on that in multiple episodes of this show.
It's scary. It's scary. If you are over 25, that happened while you were alive.
Yeah.
And if you're old enough to have seen it, it's spooky how we used to say citizen and now we say consumer. So gross, man. But Navient says, and in Navient's case, to be fair, these are consumers.
Yeah.
It's a publicly traded company. So Navient says that most of the problems that people are complaining about come from the structural issues surrounding college finance, like terms of the loans. And that, they say, is up to the federal government and the private banks. We don't make the rules. They say we're just doing our job, filling the contract. So the complaints are not about our customer service, they're complaining about the wrong thing. They should be complaining about the banks and the feds.
We didn't make the product. We're just the customer service.
In 2016, they received 23 complaints per 100,000 people, borrowers. See, I feel like words like consumer and borrowers are trying to distance us from the fact that these are people.
Talking about the borrowers, those little people that live in the walls? And
I never saw that. Was that any good?
They're just little guys. They have like a whole city in the walls.
And they're like hoarders or something?
Yeah, they borrow.
Oh, okay. That makes sense.
Isn't there a mayor like Bobbledoonery or something?
Yeah, Julius Bobbledoonery.
Yeah, I forgot. Okay.
So that number, 23 complaints per 100,000, is more than twice that of their nearest competitor. From 2014 to 2016, Navient was named as a defendant in 530 separate distinct federal lawsuits.
Which actually seems a little bit low to my ear.
Well, yeah. How are you going to afford to help file a lawsuit?
That's true. Okay. Yep.
I mean, really, there should probably be more, but they do make a salient point when they say, you know, Navient as an organization is not capable of making the federal government change its interest rates for you.
True.
They can't really do that. They can, however, lobby, and they do, and they don't lobby in your best interest. When we go into the world of conspiratorial or cover-up thinking with student loans, one of the things we run into is an interesting argument. I don't know if you guys had heard this before. I never really thought about it this way. There are critics who will argue that the practice of indebting people for going to college has become a form of indentured servitude, primarily because it's so difficult to discharge the loan and it makes you much more likely to get hooked on a paycheck-to-paycheck lifestyle.
Yeah. I hate to give my opinion here too much, but I could totally see that argument, not necessarily as being true, but at least ringing very, very true of all of the different loans that we take out over the course of an average middle-class American lifestyle. Just the sheer number of loans that we take out that are large enough that cause us to be paying them for decades. Mm-hmm. I mean, easily decades. Everything from, you know, your house to your car, depending on what you buy,
helicopter.
To your loan. Well, to, I mean,
not to mention the helicopter pad that you have to have installed on your house.
It's a
you're
whole
still paying
thing.
On.
You have to get it. Like, legally, you have to get the pad, which I think is malarkey.
Well, no, and to your point, Matt, I mean, these are a lot of things, too, that are similarly to the American dream of college. They're pushed on people to the point where they feel like if they don't do it, if they don't sign the paperwork, they don't get into that space, they are less than, and they will be seen as less than, whether it's status-wise or whether it means they won't be able to get that job or they won't be taken seriously for that, meteoric rise in position that they plan to plot, you know, that means they did a good job at life. Mm-hmm. That's a thing, you know? I mean, the whole idea of buying a house has its own drawbacks and issues involved, you know, inherent in it.
Oh, absolutely. And to your point, Ben, that you were saying earlier, of all of these loans, the student loan is probably I would consider it to be the most nefarious because it is so difficult to discharge. Mm-hmm. It's that one hook that sticks in you, even if you declare bankruptcy.
Yeah, right. Yeah, totally.
And so at this point, we can see why that argument exists. One of the questions we have to ask is indentured servitude to whom, right? Who are you serving in this situation? The argument will usually be something along the lines of, well, we're making sure that people are too busy, scared, and anxious to rise up against the status quo. It's kind of like an Occupy argument, if you remember the Occupy protest from a few years back. So it's not specific. But while that is a maybe more of a fringe accusation, it also reminds us of the argument that the prison system replaced the system of chattel slavery, which has some other very depressing and very compelling points to it. You know what I mean? In this case, what we can see, however, is a clear financial incentive for this system, which is predatory in some ways, to continue. Now, is it predatory to let people borrow money from school for schooling, for education, and expect them to pay it back? Absolutely not. Is it predatory to change the laws and move the goalpost while these people are already attempting to pay this thing back? Yes, I would argue that is very much predatory.
And there are, you know, things in place little by little that are allowing some people to get, quote unquote, forgiven for some of these loans, especially when it comes to taking out loans for some of these for-profit colleges that have been wrapped up in so much litigation. I believe there is actually a system where you have to be notified that you're eligible, but if you went in to debt to go to one of these for-profit colleges and then they kind of did a fly-by-night move and disappeared and you were left on the hook, there are ways to get forgiven for that debt. But overall, it's a lot of people making some kind of rash decisions at a time when they feel compelled to do so. Maybe they're not thinking of the full implications of, is this degree going to make me enough money to actually pay back this debt? And then there's this vicious cycle, right?
Yeah. Honestly, what would benefit most people entering college now or considering it is – all right. We need – like you guys remember the DARE program, which absolutely did not work, right? We talked about this before.
Yeah, right? DARE not to do drugs.
Mm-hmm. DARE to give a kid some hope.
Yeah.
So there have been a ton of PSAs with things like, this is your brain on drugs, or, you know, if you look at someone once, you will get an STD. Abstinence is the only way. All those kinds of things. I found them hilarious. They were probably well-intentioned, but they did not work in the way that the people who created them wish they would. We could use some heavy-handed alarmist PSAs about the student loan industry for kids who are juniors or seniors in high school.
Even early high school, I would say. Just so as soon as you get in that environment, you're thinking about it and you can bring something to your parents.
Yeah.
I don't know. I would lobby for that.
We also need more mandatory financial awareness classes.
Yeah.
And people should just have to take a budget class in high school.
Why is that? It makes no sense. So many things they make you take that are such a waste of time, like that would really set a foundation.
Yeah.
They expect your parents to teach you, but so many people's parents are bad at money.
Right, right. What's the incentive to teach it, though? That's where the question gets tricky.
Are you saying that it's almost like systematic that we keep people in the dark about smart financial decisions so that the powers that be can reap the benefits?
I'm just saying it seems like an easy win to say, hey, let's teach people basic budgeting.
Home economics, man. Eighth grade. Y'all didn't get that?
Underwater basket weaving.
Okay.
Sixth grade.
I mean, Matt, you might be laughing now, but I'm telling you, if you catch this guy with some straw in a pool.
I don't doubt it.
Oh, I am out of control.
It's a beautiful thing to watch.
And it's cool. You know what's even better than underwater basket weaving? Synchronized underwater basket weaving when you have a whole group of people doing it.
I don't know. It creeps me out.
In sync.
Which is what the boy band is named after, right? That's how they all met.
That's totally right.
So is this a bubble? This is one of the big concerns. I mean, not underwater basket weaving or boy bands. I think K-pop is here to stay also. But is this student loan situation a bubble? The answer for a lot of people is going to be yes, but the answer for a lot of people is going to be no. We should explain what we mean when we say a bubble in terms of economics. So there's a guy named Brent Goldfarb, a professor of business at the University of Maryland. He's an author of a book called Bubbles and Crashes, The Boom and Bust of Technological Innovation. And he says the best way to think of a bubble in financial terms is to think about a stock that people keep buying mostly because other people are buying the same thing. It's a herd movement. And then Vice wrote a pretty solid article about this, and they said the best known examples of recent bubbles would be the mortgage crisis, the homes that people live in the U.S. So what happened is at least two different sets of people started thinking the price of something, housing in this case, was just going to keep going up. So people kept buying property for inflated prices, and people kept lending the money to do so. Right. Eventually, the center cannot hold, like Chinua Achebe says. And so another bubble would be the dot-com stock bubble in the 2000s. Right. And they were very different, but they shared one thing. The mass runaway delusion about how much people thought something was worth versus how much it was actually worth. And the problem here is that people say people feel like companies like Navient and Wall Street Investors and colleges and universities are accelerating this bubble because people are saying, well, a college education is worth so much over the span of my life that I should go to college even if it costs twice what it did when my parents went, right? And of course, we do have to mention that scholarships are great. Get a scholarship if you can, right?
Yeah, just write some essays.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And one of my relatives said it this way. They're like, no, you have to toil away like a slave in high school so that you can enjoy your life later.
Okay.
It was tough love, but they were right. So now we're in a situation where some economists worry that we will reach a point where we have generations of people who can never afford a home, are having a very difficult time raising children, let alone saving for retirement. That's a pipe dream at this point. And that eventually they may reach a breaking point. And just like the scene in that R.E.M. music video during the traffic jam, everybody hurts, people might just get out of their cars and walk away. In this situation, they may just stop paying their loans and say, screw the credit rating, this system is not real, rage against the machine, bulls on parade, eat the rich.
And the thing is, I know plenty of people who, again, like I feel like a jerk, but I mean, I pay my bills, but sometimes I let the student loan one kind of lapse because they haven't really given me an incentive to not do so. I never really get charged late payments. It's not that big of a deal if I forget to pay occasionally and just have to get a couple of annoying phone calls. But I know people that have gone years without paying. And if more people start acting like that, that's when the bubble burst happens, right, Ben?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. It's something that takes cooperation from all sides. And some people have gone so far as to leave the U.S. entirely and start, I kid you not, an entirely different life in a foreign country. I would refer to Vice again. They have an excellent article on this by Alexander Coggan, Debt Dodgers, the Americans who moved to Europe and went AWOL on their student loans. And you can find various stories of people who moved to Europe and maybe some other countries because they felt like they had no choice. They had no way to get a decent job that would allow them to pay back the loan. And now it's a shame that we're not going to be able to end this with a nice bow or a ribbon, a nice pat answer.
Well, and it's because it never ends. And it's because of this thing called forbearance. That's what it is. I'm telling you, that's why this doesn't end. This is one of the primary reasons that this whole thing seems to be an issue.
So forbearance, we mentioned it as the meaner cousin of deference.
But if you really think about this, and this is exactly what my wife did, and it's why I'm going to be paying student loans for the rest of my life probably, even though I didn't take any. It's because she went into forbearance with her student loans at one point. And rather than just the money, the loan being on freeze and you don't have to pay anything, the interest continues to accumulate as you're not making any payments for whatever the allotted period of time is. It can be a year. It can be 6 months. It just depends. And then that interest, it's not like it goes away. It gets added to the principal of the loan.
Is that right? The same thing as having a loan that's in rehabilitation, like rehabilitating a loan? That's a term that I've heard thrown around as well. I don't think it is.
I don't know.
But there is something where when you just straight up don't pay your loan and then you start having conversations with the lender to get back on track, they assess how much you can actually afford to pay, and it can be quite a little amount of money, but just getting back on track to paying that loan. But you're never going to pay it off. They just want something from you, you know?
Well, yeah. Right. And that's the thing with forbearance, because as you're adding to that principal, Noel, you were talking about how hard it is to pay off your principal because you are paying such a large percentage of interest with every payment. It's terrifying that there are so many humans that are stuck in this kind of deal.
In this cycle.
Because they were either told that forbearance would be a good idea for them, or it would be a band-aid basically to fix your current financial situation where you can't afford to pay your student loan payment. Mm-hmm. But then it wraps you up for the next 30 years.
According to statements by former loan servicing employees, forbearance was one of the go-to ways to process a call. They were instructed to keep calls under 7 minutes, 7 minutes or less if they could. And the easiest way to do that was to tell somebody about the joys of forbearance. It is a short-term Band-Aid with long-term ramifications. Now, Navient, for their part, and other private loan servicers are doing pretty well in this environment. Since 2014, their execs have given around $75,000 to the company's Political Action Committee, or PAC, which pumped money into different campaigns on the state level to try to prevent some states from tackling the debt crisis. They've spent more than $10.1 million lobbying Congress. $4.2 million of that spending alone came from came since 2016. So that means that Navient's lobbying is increasing in step with the bubble. All of the stakes are getting higher. There's more and more and more money and people involved, and more children's futures. I mean, that's cliche, but it's true. So where does this leave us now? Now, let's be honest. There are a lot of people who will say, this is an issue of personal responsibility. You make your bed, you sleep in it. And there is something to that, right? But it is disingenuous at best to say that these people are given full awareness of what they are agreeing to do.
Yeah.
That's why in any experiment, you hear the phrase informed consent rather than consent. And this is an important difference. And maybe it's not a one-on-one comparison, but it's still a pretty good one. Student loans began as a means of allowing less privileged Americans to chase previously unobtainable parts of the American dream. And now, regardless of how you feel about individual cases, on a national level, this has become a paralyzing generational problem. What happens when no one can pay the debt? What happens when no one can buy a house? Are we going to get to that point? I mean, that's dystopian, that's alarmist, but it is distantly in the cards. Luckily, now, if you are listening and you're underwater or a student loan or someone you care about is, you can find counseling for student loans. There are numerous counseling services. Go with a nonprofit one or a government-sponsored one, just because some might be scams. Some loan consolidation things are scams. I'm sure you've met someone who has received one of those weird notices, or maybe you received one where they will, you know, send you junk mail disguised to look official.
It's all about due diligence. Like, seriously, get online, find out what people are saying about whatever company it is or whatever group or governmental organization before you do anything.
Mm. And like you said, Noel, there are forgiveness programs, right? Two that may be of great interest to some of us, the Teacher Student Loan Forgiveness Program and Public Service Loan Forgiveness Program. This means if you work in a qualified job for a number of years, poof, your loan has disappeared. But the problem here is that not everyone can take these sorts of jobs for one reason or another, right? Then the big thing on the table off and on again all the time is student loan refinancing. But what is that?
So let's put it like this. What if borrowers could reduce their interest rates? This is the question that proponents of refinancing are asking. And in this case, technically, they'd be able to pay back their loans on time, improving their own credit and financial well-being while supporting the integrity and sustainability of the federal loan program. Seems like a win-win. Yet, refinancing is incredibly expensive. In 2014, the Congressional Budget Office estimated that Senator Elizabeth Warren's refinancing plan would cost just shy of $60 billion over a three-year period, or twice the annual cost of the federal Pell Grant program.
So it's expensive.
Yeah.
Also, the way it would work out, the savings on that refinancing wouldn't be that much on an individual level, and it wouldn't It would help people who are already capable of paying loans more than would help people who are already defaulted or having difficulty, you know?
It's the same as like refinancing your house, right?
Yeah,
you get a better rate. Mm-hmm. You technically are able to pay it quicker because you're not getting eaten alive by high interest and late fees and things like that.
Exactly. And right now, I believe there is a federal case going forward. A judge ordered the Department of Education to implement a student loan forgiveness rule that meets a couple – I think it's what you were talking about. It meets a – you have to meet a couple of different requirements, and it's in reaction to those really sketchy schools that closed down, right, and left their students high and dry. So there is hope. There is always an action you can take. But the next time someone tells you that millennials or insert generation here is wasting their money on avocado toast or whatever, many
so
of,
good though, man. It's
it
so
is.
Good.
It is, and it's not that expensive. You make it at home.
You can
That's
make it
the
at home.
Secret.
It's just as good. Just as good. Yeah.
So the next time someone spews that kind of stuff, just remember that a lot of these people are probably scraping by, and it's not out of laziness that people aren't, you know, buying houses or having 2.5 kids. It's a matter of survival for a lot of people.
That's right. Okay. Do you have a student loan story that you want to tell us that won't make us all feel just absolutely terrible? Or maybe one of those that you just want to share to get it off your chest?
Yeah. Do you have something that's like a PSA for your fellow listeners about student loans? Do you have an inspiring student loan story with a happy ending?
And do you want to deliver it in your own voice with the potential of it actually ending up on an episode of the show?
Give us a call. We are 1-833-STDWYTK. As the chorus of voices tells your ears, the acronym of our show, call that number.
And don't forget, there's a 3-minute cutoff. So either try to get your story in tight three or be prepared to do a part two.
Tight three is preferable.
It really is.
Okay. So if you guys don't want to do that, you can find us in most places on social media. We are at Conspiracy Stuff on Instagram. We are at Conspiracy Stuff Show.
Oh, yeah. And if you want to see some of my various misadventures before I get disappeared, I'm at Ben Bolin.
I am at Embryonic Insider if you want to see cute kid and kitty pics and maybe some modular synth nerdery.
Yeah. And I am at 1-872-241-11111.
Just rolls off the tongue. You can also find us and, more importantly, your fellow listeners on Facebook, right?
We have a group called Here's Where It Gets Crazy. You either have to name one of us by name to get in or just say something really clever that lets us know that you actually care about the show.
Honestly, if one of the four of us chuckles, you're probably in.
Totally. Yeah. And if you don't want to do any of that, you can send us a good old-fashioned email where we are.
Conspiracy at howstuffworks.com.